Today's program has been brought to you by 360 Cookware. Their stainless steel cookware uses vapor technology to cook better tasting, more nutritional food. To learn more and receive 20% off, click their logo on our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Thank you for listening every Wednesday at 11 o'clock to our live broadcast from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This Wednesday, if I sound a little nasal, I apologize. I'm fighting a head cold, but the show must go on. And so we are here today with a very special guest here in Brooklyn with us. Maricel Precia is a James Beard Award-winning chef and co-owner of two fabulous restaurants in Hoboken, New Jersey. Yes, there are James Beard Award-winning restaurants in Hoboken, New Jersey. And if you haven't been, you must go. They are Zafra and Cuchara Mama. And in addition to being a wonderful proponent and practitioner of the cuisines of Latin America, Maricel has just written an incredible book, the definitive book, a lifetime of work and research, at least since I've known you, the 15 years ago that we've met, you've been working on it, called The Gran Cocina Latina, The Food of Latin America. Thank you for joining us, Maricel.
Thank you, Mitchell, for having me here. It's such a pleasure.
We're so glad that in your busy schedule, and we'll talk a little bit about what takes you around the world constantly, that you could join us here in our little shipping container attached to Roberta's
restaurant.
It's a lovely place.
I have never seen a radio station that looks as cool as this one.
It is true. Almost too cool for us. But they let us in.
I didn't want to talk to you. I wanted to eat.
We're going to do that later.
The smells of that food are incredible.
Indeed. And speaking of smells and flavors and the sort of sensory overload of food, tell us about this. Tell us about the cuisine of Latin America. What are we talking about? What is Latin America? Let's start
What
there.
Is Latin America? Actually, is a chapter.
Oh, really?
Okay. The book is actually the introductory chapter. It's a question that I ask myself because being Cuban doesn't make me an immediate Latin American. I had to experience the geographic Latin America. I had to meet Latin Americans out of Cuba because when I was growing up, I basically never met anyone else.
Right.
You know, I never met a Puerto Rican. I met my first Puerto Rican in Spain when I went to live in Spain. So I wasn't prepared to really understand Latin America just from the perspective of reading.
Right.
I was a voracious reader. So I knew Latin America from novels, from geography books, history books. So I had to travel. And what I found is a world that I understood perfectly well. Because every country that I visited share a part of my own history. And I believe that we, you know, as a construct, we are united because of an ugly history.
Latin America is united. It's a colonial history.
It's a colonial history. And, right. and colonialism, it's a dirty word in many ways.
Slavery, in the colonies, anyway.
Exactly. Right. Slavery, for example, is a part of that colonial history. But however, that is the binding glue that unites us. I mean, the many threats that make up colonialism are the things that unite us culturally and also in terms of food.
So let's enumerate a couple of those threads. There's the language, obviously.
Well, first of all, you know, the simplest definition for me, when I was trying to look at the countries that I would feature, I decided that my definition of Latin America included only countries that had been created out of the disintegration of the Iberian colonial powers and countries where Spanish or Portuguese was spoken.
Okay.
So basically that eliminated, you know, the French Islands, which I adored, or Belize and places of that, you know, that spoke other languages. So I, you know, I made that conscious decision, which facilitated a number of things because, of course, we share religion. There's a cultural component there that comes from the Iberian Peninsula. It's all that medieval history that is so complex, you know, has to do with Muslims being in the Iberian Peninsula for such a long time and just giving us that rich Mediterranean legacy. So those elements of culture are the basically the foundations, you know, the founding stones of our gastronomic culture.
And how do they play out in food, both in the food culture, but also in the actual ingredients in the dishes cooked? What are the similarities or the threads?
Well, I mean, obviously, you have a foundation of New World ingredients, fine, but the way in which many of those ingredients are treated and integrated with other things that came from all over the world, that cooking grammar, mm-hmm. you know, having to do with techniques, is Iberian and is Mediterranean in many cases. And I always talk about the sofrito being, you know, just the primary element that you need to look at.
And the sofrito is?
The sofrito is a cooking sauce, very simple cooking sauce. It could be garlic and onions. But usually it has different permutations. So it's, you know, you start with frying some, sauteing some garlic in, you know, any type of fat. It could be lard, it could be olive oil, it could be a combination of things. Mm-hmm. Or render the fat, render fat. From bacon. Uh-huh. And then you add other elements. It might be tomatoes, or it might be some wine, or it might be some chorizo, or it might be spices. It could be oregano or cumin. Right. And so, I mean, the differences essentially are the flavorings that mm-hmm. you would add to that. If you have lots of cumin, well, everybody likes cumin. But let's say the Ecuadorians, for example, their cooking sauce, which is not called sofrito, you know, they call it differently.
But it's still the same.
It's the same, uh-huh. but it has a lot of cumin. Uh-huh. That combination of oregano and cumin is very Cuban. And if you go to my hometown, Santiago de Cuba, in the easternmost part of the island, it's Old Spice, which is not used anywhere else.
Right.
But that's like a signature. When you know you smell Old Spice in a cooking sauce from Cuba, you know immediately you're talking about something from eastern Cuba and primarily Santiago, Guantanamo.
Well, so the grammar is that distinct.
There's, exactly. Right. The technique is there, but then the differences, you know, are sort of elements of flavor and aroma that are signature statements from different countries.
So talk a little bit about the process, because so we're talking 21 countries, I believe.
Yeah. And of course we had to deal with the United States, which is my mantra lately.
How so?
Well, I told you that my book was not nominated, won the Gourmand Cookbook Award, you know, this French competition. But it won as a Latin American book of the US.
Right.
So I'm competing. I mean, there are five books, and the other four books are from different parts of Latin America. But mine is representing the U.S. So I'm going to the world finals representing the U.S., which is great.
But there's a huge Latin American component to our culture and to our food.
But what I'm saying, and this is something that I repeat in every interview, is that my book was the product of the U.S.,
right.
Because I was able to buy every single ingredient I needed.
Amazing.
At a short distance from my own home in New Jersey.
Right.
And what that means is if I had tried to write this book, let's say in Argentina, it would have been extremely hard for me to get, for example, the Mexican chiles, or vice versa. Had I been in Mexico, I wouldn't have been able to get the Andean ingredients. So this is the product of the U.S.
Interesting.
And because everyone is coming together, all the Latin Americans that are here for different reasons, you know, we are all immigrants with great needs, but we have come together somehow reluctantly because of our, you know, of the nature of, you know, of our culture and also the nature of our needs. You know, we live in the same neighborhoods, we work in the same factories, we watch the same soap operas. So, you know, we bond in ways that are very peculiar. And let's say, for example, that I tell you, you know, I have a great assistant from Ecuador, but she's a Jehovah's Witness. Mm-hmm. And I have seen the way in which they have social events where everyone comes together from different Latin American countries and they all bring dishes. So they have potluck events where everybody comes
representing
together.
Representing all of the countries in your
exactly.
book, practically.
So even if you guard your cooking pot jealously and you think that what you cook is the best food in the world, and how dare somebody else claim that they have the best, you know, a better rice and chicken or a better, you know, bean stew. When you taste your neighbor's food and if it's really good, you're going to want the recipe. So this is how this, you know, process of interaction and coming together, you know, as a whole takes place.
Right.
In terms of, you know, our culinary history.
You've preempted my next question and in some ways started to answer it, but I'd like to explore it a little bit more, which is whether or not there's a concept of Latin America within Latin America or if it's imposed on it from America, you know, so that whether there's an appreciation in Argentina for the food of Mexico, for instance, even if you can't get the chilies, is there a sense of a hole there, or is it something implied, imposed by everyone else, even in a form of postmodern colonialism, let's say?
Well, think about borders being artificial lines.
Right.
But think about how new our history is. You know, it basically starts in the 19th century.
Amazing.
So, and these countries were carved out of, you know, whims of men.
Right.
And
European
also
men.
Exactly. You know, well, colonial men. And there is a lot of regionalism. So it's not even a question of national pride, but just regionalism. The people of my hometown, for example, thought, you know, we were the ultimate. This is the ultimate town. You would never leave Santiago de Cuba, but we did leave. In fact, we left in such numbers after, you know, the revolution that we were called Palestinians in Cuba.
Really?
In Havana, some people from Santiago de Cuba are called Palestinians, you know, which is kind of a, you know, complicated thing.
Yeah, very.
To topic for another show. To grasp, exactly.
Right.
But so we are jealous of each other. Right. And especially in South America, you have, you know, the political issues and countries have fought with each other. For example, Peruvians and Ecuadorians, you know, the Peruvians have a big chunk of the Ecuadorian Amazon. So there are kinds of things, you know, happening subliminally. It's
right.
It's changing with the new generations, obviously. But or Bolivians and Paraguayans, Chileans and Bolivians. So so people feel very strongly that they belong to a country or to a region or a town. And that really affects the way in which you cook and mm-hmm. in the way you see other people's cuisine. If you're a Venezuelan and you love arepas, you might think you have the best arepas in the world. You might be reluctant to try a Colombian arepa that is somehow, you know, from a particular area in Colombia that is drier than yours, that is filled with cheese. But even if you're in Colombia, if you're from Barranquilla or Cartagena, you might think that your cheese-filled arepa, which is oozing cheese and is just plump and moist, is better than something from Cali. And so, you know, we do have these regionalisms that are very strong. So when people come here, somehow by the nature of our process of immigration, and you go, let's say, to a Dominican restaurant where there are Cuban black beans or a Cuban sandwich or a Cuban restaurant where, you know, the favorite meat that everybody will order is not the Cuban palomilla,
right?
But the skirt steak, you know, which is the Argentinian, it's called generically churrasco, it's entraña, with the chimichurri sauce. So you get that in a Cuban restaurant. Entraña, you know, the churrasco with chimichurri sauce is the favorite meat dish, which is, but this is the whole process of, you know, this is truly the melting pot of Latin America.
Right. And I'm going to remind people listening, if you haven't figured it out, we have the world expert on the cuisine of Latin America.
I
in
love
our midst.
The way you sound.
Well, you, I mean, who can have this conversation, Maricel? I mean, there
well,
are not many people who could talk about it in this way.
The thing is, you know, I took too long to write this book, and you know, you've been asking
forever,
me for 15
yes.
years, and because I was let loose, essentially, traveling, and I love traveling and researching even more than writing.
There's something about, I mean, walking into this restaurant today, your eyes lit up about this, what was here, and oh my God, and you want to take it all in. And that's something that comes
through
in the book.
Oh, I wanted to interview the chef immediately.
Right. As soon as you got here. And I think that's part of what, I just can't imagine you ever stopping. I'm gonna tell people at home that if they have questions about the food of anywhere in Latin America or Spain, you have a degree in medieval Spanish
history, which I haven't really explored. I ate my way through Spain. And in fact, I did exactly the same thing I did in Latin America in Spain. I was doing my PhD in medieval Spanish history.
Right.
I was writing a dissertation on the image of death, the politics of death and salvation in 13th century Spain. But
as I
travel everywhere in Spain, I was cooking and I was learning about the food because that's the way I do things. And that's exactly what happened to me in Latin America. I started traveling for fun, but soon I was taking down recipes with incredible detail. I remember being in Oaxaca just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know, a vacation that I have not had a vacation like that ever again. And I was a month. I spent a month with my husband. And who spends a month? I cannot spend a month anywhere.
No, right?
and I found this incredible tamales with black mole, and I just had to have the recipe. So I asked the woman, "Could you teach me?" Mm-hmm. I was on vacation. Who does that? So the next day I went to her house. Then she took me to a little hostel that she had opened, and she taught me this black mole recipe. Well, guess what? That recipe is in the book.
Oh,
and this is something that happened
years ago. Before,
ooh, my God,
there was
25 years
right.
ago. Exactly. I didn't have an idea that I would write. I thought I would write history books, but right. not a cookbook.
Well, we'll talk about that concept too, but I'll remind folks at home that if you have any questions for Maricel, you can call us at 718-497-2128, where the lines are open and operators are standing by. If you're listening to the podcast, or maybe you are listening to the archive, you can also email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can tweet us at TasteMattersHRN. We will be right back with Maricel Procia.
You are listening to PR in America by Rene Lopez on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by AmeriCraft. AmeriCraft and 360 Cookware are proud sponsors of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. AmeriCraft is an American company, and like Heritage Radio Network, they provide the best. Their 360 Cookware is made of the highest quality ingredients, like United States steel. It is made in the greenest cookware manufacturing plant in the world. AmeriCraft makes great cookware and is focused on improvement. 360 Cookware is their exclusive line. It's a contemporary line of cookware and bakeware intended to let you, the Heritage Radio Network listeners, have a unique cooking experience. Its vapor seal allows food to be cooked in its natural juices, preserving all of the vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients without added water, oils, or fats. 360 Cookware invites you to learn more about how this process works on their website, www.360cookware.com.
We are back in the studio with Maricel Procia, the author of The Gran Cocina Latina. And grand it is, both in conception and in size. This is a large, heavy book.
I like to look at it. I mean, in your hands, it looks enormous.
It's enormous. And so part of one of my questions is, even though it is this enormous, one imagines with your curiosity and your enthusiasm for new things and new flavors and new sensory experiences, that editing down even to this large size, the food of 21 countries and however many more cultures, was not an easy process.
No, it wasn't. And the book would have been much larger, but it
right.
would have been impossible
to
publish.
The encyclopedia of Gran Cocina.
But I had a good editor, Maria Guarnaschelli, and she helped me make good choices. I mean, we had to cut down recipes, but she was very respectful about the text and the introductions to each chapter, which are filled with history and personal insight. And she was extremely careful in preserving my voice, and I'm very grateful to her for that.
That's fantastic. Not everyone gets to say that. Not every yes. author says that mm-hmm. about their editor. But so, and ultimately, it was your taste that determined the final recipe for
the... Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When people say, well, this is an encyclopedia, and I correct them, it is encyclopedic in terms of size
right.
and perhaps
scope.
Because it's very well organized, like encyclopedias are in many cases, but it's Latin America through my personal insight. And
right.
because I took the trouble to get to know Latin America in person, to go
right.
everywhere, it's not an armchair book because I'm not that kind of a writer. I need to experience things firsthand. I am a primary source person
uh-huh.
because that comes from my academic background. Being a medievalist, having been trained in cultural anthropology also, I am a careful researcher.
Uh-huh.
I take notes. I do very thorough analysis of things. So it's not just reading cookbooks. I go to libraries and archives I looked at documents and testaments, anything that could illuminate a culinary culture from a very broad perspective. So that is a part of the work that I did for the book, but also it is, I need to put my hand on everything, essentially. So the book has my perspective. It's Latin America through the prism of my own experience in Latin America.
And I think that's what makes it, even though it's large and grand in scope, that's what makes it so approachable. Because
no, it is totally
there.
Personal. Yeah. And I wanted to share the experience as if I were telling you a story, the story of my life. And indeed, it is the story of my life.
And to what extent did your restaurants factor into this process? They are pan-Latin, to use a word.
They're pan-Latin, but if you go to my restaurants, and actually not only my two restaurants, but also my store,
right.
Ultramarinos, well, you're eating my book. Because, in fact, they came after the book.
Started.
I had been working on this book for quite a while, and I opened my first place, Safra, in 2000. So, right. And I used the recipes from the book to start Safra. And I did exactly the same thing with Cuchara Mama. So many of the recipes in Cuchara Mama came from this book. Obviously, I have continued traveling for different reasons. I have traveled because I write articles for Savoir Magazine. Like I wrote,
James
Beard
award-winning articles, I'll say.
Exactly. And I have traveled and integrated elements, you know, foods that I have found in my travels in my restaurant's menu. And also, you know that I'm very involved with chocolate and cacao.
Right. Yes.
I do have a company called Gran Cacao. So I source cacao from Latin America and I have connections with farms and everywhere. And I continue doing work with cacao. And lately I've been doing a lot of work in Ecuador. So after every trip, I come back with treasure trove of recipes. And I have almost like a complete Ecuadorian menu right now in Cuchara Mama because I'm falling in love with Ecuador. And these are things that I brought lately.
Amazing. So for someone who may not be as familiar with these cuisines or for someone who I guess what are the myths you encounter? I mean, having had so much firsthand experience, what would you say if the American cookbook audience or eating audience got something out of this book, what would you think their takeaway ought to be? What would make you satisfied that you had accomplished something besides being able to make a delicious arepa or...
Well, I take you by the hand and, you need to read the introductory chapters because I tell you, I tell you a lot about Latin flavor, the things that we look for in a meal. I give you a very close look at the components of Latin cooking. So just by having those recipes at hand, you can create Latin American cooking.
Uh-huh.
But I'm teaching you what is expected, in the various regions of Latin America from a good meal. And these are things that you internalize. And then when you get to a recipe, you understand. Because you understand the recipe because you already know the principles. And that brings me to the topic of authenticity. You know, how do you keep the authenticity of a dish? I look at authenticity of taste and flavor. And also, I look at the intention of a recipe.
Okay.
For example, deconstruction doesn't work for me. I mean, I've seen key lime pies deconstructed. Right. I've seen...
Oh, Spain is the land of
deconstruction. Right, right. You know, that you have all these different components.
And they mix
you
in your
put them in your mouth and then you are taken on a trip. Well, you know what? It doesn't take me on any trip. the deconstruction doesn't work for me because some foods require a particular matrix and they're meant to be together. The ingredients are meant to be together for synergy and for something else. And I'm going to give you a good example. And this is an example that involves a chef that I love from a Latin American country. Well, let's say Ecuador. The ceviches from Ecuador are juicy. They're soupy. And in some cases, you have a combination of lime juice and orange juice. With the fish or shrimp, and then they add some ketchup at the table and mustard, and they just mix it all up with the onions and everything, and it becomes like a reddish sauce. Okay, if I take something like that, let's say I take ceviche from a place called Hippie Japa, which is one of the recipes in the book. Hippie Japa is in Manabí on the coast of Ecuador, and they add peanuts to that, which mellows the citrus juice. Is great. All right. So I see my friend taking my ceviche from my restaurant and just taking the shrimp out, plating it very nicely on a flat, not on a bowl, where that juice, you know.
Right, the soupiness.
So he took the shrimp out, put it on a plate where it looked beautiful with a little bit of, you know, just a few of the onions and a little bit of the juice. Okay, you eat that, it's very pretty. But what he missed was the intention of the dish. You know what the intention of the dish is? To enjoy the seafood, but also to enjoy that soupy stuff. And you eat it with a spoon.
Right.
Because that's where the combination of elements takes place, where you would mix the peanuts and all that. So what I would do, instead of having tons of ketchup for that particular ceviche, I would probably make tomato juice. Mm-hmm.
Modernize it somehow. I modernize elevate it. The quality
exactly.
of the
tomato
ingredients.
Juice, and then I put a little bit of the ketchup because there is a sweetness there that is necessary. And I would put a little bit of the mustard, but it would be fresher.
Right.
But I would not deconstruct it. I would not serve these different components separately on a flat plate where the juice is lost. If I have to modernize it, I would use maybe a fantastic Japanese bowl, something absolutely gorgeous made by an artisan. And I would prop the shrimp, and I would make the peanuts look, you know, nicer. Right. And I would create a whole presentation, but the presentation has to preserve the intention.
You're describing the food at Kucharamama.
Which exactly. Which
and
is
the dishware.
Exactly. So you would use your spoon and you would drink that beautiful juice, and then you would have your shrimp, which is secondary to the broth.
Mm-hmm. This is an interesting phenomenon that I've witnessed. Even we were walking around this restaurant, and there's two different restaurants here. I mean, there's many different restaurants, but there's the casual trattoria or bistro, whatever you want to call it, and then there's the fancy Blanca, the tasting menu in the back. And one of the joys of eating in the casual part of Roberta's is getting more, scooping another piece out, like sort of relishing in the experience of eating rather than the objectified, unique, contained tasting or taste of a dish. And to me, I've never heard it expressed as the intention before, but that resonates with something I'm less and less satisfied by in fancy European style
restaurants. Exactly, because the intention is to satisfy by drinking this juice as a soup.
Right.
So if you lose sight of that intention, when you deconstruct, you lose the essence of the dish. So you have to be very careful when you modernize, because you have to really look at, there are saucy dishes, there are, you know, stews that require sauce because you're going to have a carbohydrate. You're going to have either polenta, or you're going to have some rice, you're going to have some starchy vegetable. So you can't turn that into a dry dish just because it would look prettier.
Right.
You might not have everything swimming in broth or sauce. Right. You might make it, you know, just make a point of maybe using less of the sauce, but you can't forget that sauce is meant for something else. And the symphony that is created on the plate when you add that starch to that sauce is what makes the dish traditional.
Right. It's what gives you the interaction of you and the dish.
Absolutely.
That spooning some of this part into that part and the tastes. Like we've somehow unified the eating experience, and so that we think of it as one bite in your mouth as being all the same, the award-winning bite. We actually had Ed Baer on the show.
But at the same time, it's kind of a Eurocentric idea because Latin American foods are modular, and you cannot judge them alone.
Right.
It's like, you know, rice dish cannot be judged by itself because that dish is going to have all the components. It's going to serve to bind the sauce.
Right.
So therefore, you have to think about Latin American food as a part of a constellation. I mean, a dish is a constellation of different things. Even the little hot pepper sauce that is on the side has a purpose and a role. And you judge the dish when you taste the constellation of little elements.
So we had a mutual friend, Ed Baer, on the show talking about the downside of this award, the judge's table, the one bite to
the
make
one
a decision.
It can't. It doesn't. It does not describe the intention of the dish,
and then the dish is part of a menu and part of a meal, and it's all a larger. There's more connections than that.
Or it's like having a menu where starch, you know, Latin American menu where starches are not there, where there's no rice, or there are no other elements, you know, of starchy elements. Well, or maybe thinking that a fried banana is just,
dry,
it's just an anecdote. Right. No, the fried banana adds the sweetness. You might not do a fried banana, you might do roasted bananas, you can do plantains, you can do whatever you want, but there is a reason for that, because that touch of sweetness will intensify the salt and the spice in the dish. So you have to think, you know, this is a modular cuisine, right, where there is synergy between components. And if you don't understand that, you don't understand Latin American cooking.
And I think that's a great segue into a question that we have from one of our listeners, which is a little bit about, all of this is very exciting and sounds very wonderful, but can be overwhelming, and the size alone of this book makes it seem like maybe this is not for amateurs. What would you suggest? How do you start? What do you get in? Besides reading everything in advance, what do? Make a sofrito and go from there?
I think my recipes are huge. I mean, they take pages.
Right.
Because, and it's in part, the personality of my editor is, right, is on every page, because she made me explain things to her. And so the recipes are explanations on how to understand a technique or an ingredient.
But just because they're long doesn't mean they're hard. That always gets me in trouble.
Very hard.
It means they can be easier because you actually tell people what to do.
I tell people what to do and what to expect out of every step. You know, I tell you, you sauté the onions until you smell this.
Right.
Until the fat separates from the onions, and then that's when you stop. That's when one of the best chapters of the book is on hot pepper pots.
Okay.
The many dishes that we have in Latin America that use lots of peppers, hot peppers, and moles are included. I think my mole recipes are fantastic because I show you, you know, you can make any kind of mole just by following, you know, the groups of ingredients that I call the essential building blocks of a mole. But I tell you exactly what to do in every step. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're sauteing the ingredients, exactly what to look for, that moment where you begin to see that beautiful reddish fat separating from the solids. That's when you stop. That's when you begin to smell the essence of the mole. That's where you stop.
And ultimately, if it's all too overwhelming for you, find your way to the 22nd Latin American country, which is New Jersey, to Hoboken,
Cucharamama
and Zafra, where
so
you
much.
Can have such a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Well, you know it. You have known it forever.
When I used to tell people I was taking them to Hoboken for dinner, they would look at me like I was crazy, and everyone always wanted to come back. So thank you for coming to Brooklyn, all the way across the island in the middle we call Manhattan. And thank you all for listening. Next week, we are welcoming Krishnendu Ray, another great cultural historian, anthropologist, sociologist from New York University, the current chair of the food studies program there. And we're going to be talking about further about ethnic immigrant cuisines and authenticity and how taste plays into that. In the meantime, make something Latin and fiery and wonderful and delicious, and think of Maricel and thank her for
thank
her
you, Mitchell. And now let's have lunch, please.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.